Welcome to episode 2 of the podcast for the IBM WebSphere DataPower SOA Appliance Handbook, the book that is out there from IBM Press, which is the guide to using your DataPower appliances efficiently. In episode 1, we covered the basics. You know, what is an appliance? What is DataPower? How do you set it up? Why did we write this book? Some of that stuff. And in episode 2, I'd like to focus more on the common use cases in some of the areas that the device was designed to handle. And again, on the podcast with me, I have my co-authors John Rasmussen, Jamie Ryan, Simon Kapadia, and Jim Brennan. So I'll start out by talking about maybe the security use cases, since that's one of the really predominant areas that this device is known for. I mentioned in the first podcast, probably the big three are security, enterprise service bus, and just the simple acceleration of XML and non-XML handling and transforms. For security, we all know how important it is to have a really locked down security configuration based on standards. Okay, in my work with WebSphere Application Server, I spent a lot of time working in the security area, and we just saw countless examples of folks who had tried to go out and write their own security framework, thinking they could do a better job. They had really smart people. And upon analysis, we'd go in there and find gaping security holes, or they would call us in after they'd been hacked or exposed. So security is very important, and it's very important to use all the hard work and standards that have already been put forth by a lot of really smart people that focus in this area, cryptographic experts and so forth. And that's what the DataPower appliance is really all about. It's about taking the heavy lifting operations that are just really, really intensive for back-end application servers like digital signature verification, digital signature creation, encryption, decryption, authentication, authorization, and auditing, and all the tasks that go along with that, and taking all that intensive heavy lifting away from the back-end and putting it out into an appliance-based model with CPUs and chipsets and circuitry that are designed to do this at lightning fast speed. And it's also good because now you can move your security handling out to the perimeter of your network where it really should be done, which is in a demilitarized zone, right? The DMZ should be a hardened, barren, naked environment that doesn't have a lot of complex processes in there, such as app servers. They should never be in there. We shouldn't have Java running in there. We want this to be a hostile environment for any intruders. And we are allowing client traffic in here, right? So this is really a critical detail. And that's one of the reasons these appliances are being used so much in the DMZ for security and often on the back end for ESB. We'll talk about that later. Another big feature, as Simon touched on this in the first episode of the podcast, was the XML threat handling. And as you probably know, it's very difficult to do threat handling on an app server because it's just difficult. By the time the XML gets to the parser, it's typically game over because most of these threats will attack the parser. So you want to pick up on the fact that there's malicious content in the messages before they get to your JVM, to your Java runtimes, to your web services host. And that's what the device is all about. Due to the customized parsing and profiling technology that's built in, we're able to detect a lot of these types of threats like SQL injection threats or malicious XML. So we've got a whole chapter in the book dedicated to that. I don't want to go on ad nauseum. There's also a recording, a video recording of a presentation I did at the DevOps conference out on the internet, if you Google for that, to learn all about XML threats. And this is the sole reason that a lot of people buy the appliance. And I've often had customers come up to me after presenting on this topic, and they'll say, yeah, we know the bad guys are out there, but often our backends are cratered just because we get bad XML that's generated by our partners by accident or bugs in our own applications. So another big thing in the area of security as far as the use case is to act as sort of a security standards intermediary. We all know that we have backends. You may have BEA or .NET, WebSphere running, and all these different platforms in your back end support various degrees of the different standards that are out there. One might be on WSecurity Draft 13. Another one might be on WSecurity 1.0. Another might be on WSecurity 1.1. And with all the standards supported, like SAML and XOCOMEL on the device, You can act as an intermediary to kind of downshift or upshift based on the spec level of the different backends that are supported there. In addition to credential single sign-on scenarios, like I mentioned, the different backends you might have your BEA stuff running off Kerberos as a security credential, and your .NET using Spinego, another one using SAML, and of course your WAS stuff using LTPA. The device is capable of understanding and generating those token formats, so it really gets you a lot closer to the holy grail of enterprise platform, cross-platform single sign-on. And then there's all the authentication and authorization that you can do on the device and the auditing. Again, these are things you want to do in the DMZ, out in the perimeter of the network. You still want to do security on your back end, right? Security in layers is a wonderful thing, but you want to have a good front wall, right, to head off any types of attacks and any type of, not just malicious, but messages that aren't well-formed so that your back ends aren't spending a lot of time dealing with a bunch of junk, okay? And also for web applications, we talk about proxying web applications in the book. There's a service called the Web App Firewall that's got some specific capabilities there about checking forms against the proper parameters and values to make sure that injection's not happening, cross-site scripting attacks, those sorts of things. Often the multi-protocol gateway is used for this case as well. And I'll hint at some forthcoming capabilities in this area from DataPower as well. We know it's an XML-centric device, but folks that we are finding do want to use it for a web app proxy as well. Okay, so I think that covers the security use cases in a nutshell there. Let's talk a little bit more about integration and using the device as an enterprise service bus and or for all the types of tasks that we consider typical of an ESB. So, Jamie, will you handle that question for us?
Absolutely. Thank you, Bill. So all the security use cases that Bill just mentioned are available on the XS40, the yellow security device. And now I want to kind of take the next step in and talk about the additional integration features that are available on the XI50, which is the integration device. Obviously, there are lots of ESB use cases, and ESB as a pattern is pretty common in the industry. Lots of people mistake ESB as a product, and there's not one product that is necessarily an ESB or the be-all and end-all of ESBs. IBM has three ESB products, WebSphere ESB, WebSphere Message Broker, and DataPower. They all have their pros and cons. They all have their benefits and their own specific use cases. Obviously, I'm going to focus on the things that the DataPower is good at. So the ESB use cases that are the most common, things like routing, protocol mediation, transformation are important, and I'll talk about those in a second. But the first one I want to mention is security. Bill just talked about it, and it's great to have the XS40 as a security gateway for messages coming in from your partners. But internal security is just as important. There have been all kinds of studies about how many of the most malicious threats are internal, and so you want to protect your services from internal applications, from being called by anybody within the intranet. And so all of those security use cases that are available in the DMZ on the XS40 can also be done in the intranet on the XI50. So that's something to keep in mind. The first additional use case I'd like to talk about is content-based routing. So part of the benefit of having a parser and XML processing engine that is so powerful is really being able to inspect all parts of the message. Not just the IP layer, but the application layer, the context that you might have values in the message itself, metadata around the transaction, so who called the transaction, what HTTP headers were available, and really DataPower has access to all of these. And you can then do routing based on any of this information. So you can route based on who made the request, You can route based on what operation they're trying to call. You can route based on the incoming URI. And you can even route based on content within the message itself. So if you have a gold service for your gold customers, you can route to the application servers, the quick responding application servers, rather than maybe your silver customers, which you want to route to your standard application servers. If you want to route based on the amount of a payment, if you want to process all the largest payments first, so that you can get that money on the books and be in the black when it's time to report earnings for your company, then you can absolutely process those quicker by routing to the appropriate backend. So because we can stream through and look and inspect content as we're streaming through the entire message, it really gives you a lot more flexibility than other things which route just based on URI or a static header. Message transformation is another very common ESB type use case. So you have both different XML formats. So you might have a standard internal format and a separate external format that you have published all in all of your services. So they have all of your customers have a web service API that they know they can call your services with. But internally, you want to standardize on a particular format. And so you can convert all of those into your internal format that your applications use. This is also very helpful for things like web service versioning, where you might want to move to version 2 for your customers, but you still have some people on version 1. You can take both inputs and do the appropriate transformation to whatever level you're on in your backend. This message transformation isn't just for XML either. Certainly, it's very useful in web services and XML requests, but you might want to provide access to a backend mainframe application. So you can do binary transformations between an XML-based web service and a COBOL copybook request to a backend application. Other things, some people like to do batch processes with FTP or NFS where a message is picked up, maybe in a comma-separated value, and it needs to go into a backend application as a web service request. So really any-to-any transformation is how you can think about what we can perform on the message as it flows through the device. And that really provides a lot of flexibility, especially when coupled with kind of that next ESB use case, which is protocol mediation. So if your application, if your mainframe application is fronted by a WebSphereMQ installation, you can get to it by depositing your message on WebSphereMQ. If it's an IMS Connect application, you can connect via IMS Connect. So DataPower has a list of all of our supported protocols. Some of those are HTTP and HTTPS. Those are kind of the obvious ones for web service use cases. The others include messaging systems like WebSphereMQ, WebSphere JMS, TIBCO EMS. So even though TIBCO is not, obviously it's not an IBM product, but we see it in lots of our customers. People are using that as their internal messaging structure, and we want to play nice with as many things as are out there. Other protocols are file-based, such as FTP, FTPS, SFTP, all three of which we support now in one form or another, and NFS. So you can pick up a message off a file system, process it, and deliver it, and it really doesn't matter where you got it from or where it's going as long as it's one of our supported protocols. The other thing that the XI50 adds that really helps for integration internally is database connectivity. So our database connectivity generally is mostly used for message enrichment, so or access control. So you can go to a database to look up a username and password to see what their rights are, or to make sure that they're in the system. You can retrieve more information about an order or a user based on the information that they've provided, and then enrich the message as it goes to your backend application. Some people have also created kind of a software as a database as a service, where Data Power simply front ends your backend database. You make a request, and you get back a response that's XML formatted, but is coming directly from your database. So there's lots of different ways to approach that. But really, those are some of the common ESB features that really need to be there and be strong. And we're pretty proud of our content-based routing, our protocol mediation, and our transformation capabilities. Since Data Power internally and externally also becomes your kind of central point of enforcement of different policies, you can also do things like web services management. So you can keep track of how many times a particular web service has been called and what the average latency was. And you can export that data that we collect to products like ITTM for SOA. It's a Tivoli product that can do reporting and graphing of those requests by user, by time, all of that. So because we're that point of enforcement for your WS policy, for your web services, for your service level management, we can also collect lots of information about each of those steps. Something that we didn't really talk about in the security section was SLM, service level management. So if you want to protect your backend from spikes in traffic, not necessarily one message that'll bring down your backend, but if you know that it can only handle 500 messages per second, you can either throttle or shape that traffic to meet your backend requirements. And when we do that, we also collect data about how many messages are being received, by who, and that those service level actions can be based on really anything about the message, about the credentials that were provided, about the resource they're trying to access, and they can even be schedule-based. So you can say something like, user A can call this operation 500 times a second during business hours and 1,000 times a second after business hours. So it's pretty flexible, and the web GUI is pretty powerful as far as the policies that you can create and enforce from a simple interface. So that's really Data Power from an integration perspective on the XI-50 within the enterprise.
All right, thanks, Jamie. The other big use case, and actually the original one, was for transformation. Originally a way to speed up XML transformations, parsing, validation, and so forth. And our big programmer guy was John. He just loves XSLT. He's done a lot of work in the area. He's actually the author of the drag and drop GUI that you see when you go into the Data Power web GUI interface. That's all John's work. So, you know, he's truly a pioneer in Data Power. So I think it would be fitting to have John talk about the transformation use cases and how Data Power is used there. So John, why don't you take it away and give us some information about that?
Okay, thanks, Bill. So your question is regarding the transformation capabilities of the Data Power device. As we have mentioned previously in some of the other questions, we have mentioned that the Data Power device is at its core a highly optimized XML, XSL processing engine. And we implement all the basic functionality of the device through a combination of the purpose-built firmware and higher level utilization of those components within our XSLT. So you will find, for example, functionality such as the signing function within the Data Power device. If you were to look at the drag and drop screen and look at that sign action, that is actually implemented via a piece of XSL that leverages components within the firmware. Now, these components can be utilized by you, the developer or the user of the Data Power device. We speak within the book in three chapters of components of transformation and development within the data power device. Chapter 22 provides an introduction to data power development. And in that chapter, we talk about things such as XPath. If you're familiar with XSLT, you are probably familiar with XPath and what a powerful tool that is for the inquiry, for the querying of XML documents. I like to think of XPath. When I think of XPath, I like to think of an XML document as a tree. And looking out at a tree, I know that with XPath, I can develop XPath statements that will allow me, in essence, to address any particular leaf, a branch, or group thereof within that tree. An extremely powerful feature. So in Chapter 22, we introduce these components along with things such as namespaces, regular expressions, and the use of things within XSLT known as extension functions. Well, we'll see that the data power device provides you with a variety of extension functions, which you can use, again, to leverage the core functionality of the device. I'll speak a little bit about this later. We also provide the ability to use industry-wide or industry-known extension functions such as the EXSLT extension functions that are available from the EXSLT.org website. Again, I'll mention a little bit more about that later. Okay, well, within Chapter 23, Programming Within the Data Power Device, we talk about how one accesses messages as they traverse through a data power policy. Policies, as you may be aware, contain multiple actions. Each action can have varying effect on the message, such as digital signatures, encryption, decryption, routing, and so forth. And within a transformation step, we also have the capabilities of accessing message components and storing off particular components or message or any data we would like within variables. Variables can have various scope and lifetimes, and we talk about how one creates variables and manages those within the data power environment. We also talk about the concept of writing messages to the data power log. The data power log is actually a pretty extensive capability and also is associated with things such as the generation of SNMP alerts. So that mechanism is explained. The probe is discussed. And the probe is an extremely powerful capability that a tool within data power that allows one to walk through a processing policy and to inspect and examine all the various features of a step within a policy, such as messages as they come into an action, messages as they leave the action, perhaps being modified by the transformation XSLT. We talk about things such as filtering or rejecting messages or routing messages to dynamically designed destinations. Finally, in Chapter 24, Real World Examples, we take all the things that we've discussed in the previous two chapters and create some full examples of XSLT transformation. We do things such as interrogate metadata. There's an example that that will look at headers and either allow them to come in based upon dates. We call this example, if it's Tuesday, this must be Belgium. You may remember that from a movie starring Suzanne Plachet many years ago. But in this example, we associate HTTP headers with days of the weeks. And this allows us to explore the use of extension functions both within the data power device and its extension functions and EXSLT extension functions such as the date function. We talk about passing variables within XSLT, error control, dynamic routing of messages based upon the interrogation of X509 certificates. So we look at the distinguished name of a certificate and perform routing based upon that. This explores some of the cryptographic extension functions. And finally, the last real-world example that we use is a load balancer health check example. This is a pretty extensive example that implements a mechanism for scheduling back-end resources, back-end servers, based on an out-of-service schedule. In this particular example, we say, for example, that a back-end resource may be out of service on Tuesdays between 5 or 7, or another one might be out of service on July the 4th between 12 and 12:15. And this this example allows us to do several things. First of all, it allows us to do some pretty nice EXSLT date time processing. And it also allows us to integrate with a data power load balancing object and also integration with its health checking mechanism. So this is definitely a real world example that that you might be interested in. So programming transformation within the data power environment. First of all, you've got to love XSL. XSL is the natural language for XML processing. XPath is a powerful tool, a powerful feature of XSLT that is used so easily and elegantly in XSLT programming. Extension functions are fully supported with metadata control, variable support, I/O support. We can create extension functions that access FTP resources, ICAP resources, IMS, MQ, NFS, SMTP, SNTP, TIBCO, MQ, SQL. That's pretty inclusive list, but we'll add other protocols to that list as time goes on. Cryptographic extension functions, hashing, encryption, both asynchronous and synchronous. Full certification information, such as the subject, the issuer, and serial numbers of certs, signing, LDAP access, the list goes on. Okay, and finally, I spoke primarily about XML transformations within DataPower, but we also have the ability of transforming binary data, or non-XML data, if you will. We utilize two tools for this. One would be the WebSphere Transformation Extender, and this product can be used to map binary data through metadata such as COBOL, copybooks, or schemas, or DTDs, into an XML format, again using metadata such as schemas in a drag and drop type fashion. Contevo Analyst is also another tool that we provide accessibility to for binary transformations. But again, the long and short is binary transformation capabilities are possible in DataPower. We can take a binary file, migrate it into an XML document, perform any type of manipulation we would like using SSLT, and perhaps convert it back to binary format. All right, well, that ends my transformation discussion, Bill. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, John. John actually is based out of Boston, up in the Boston, Massachusetts area, so you might be able to tell based on his accent, although it's not as bad as a lot of folks up that way. Big hockey fan, so we spent a lot of time with John up there going to hockey games and so forth, and actually a sailor. He does a lot of sailing out his way, although I have not yet been invited on his boat. Actually, that's not true. He's invited me several times, but due to work and other factors, I just haven't been able to make it yet. So hopefully soon, John, now that the book is complete and we have a little bit of spare time on our hands. Okay, so why don't we expand a little bit on what we talked about in episode one. We had Jim talk about what you do when you receive the package from the shipping dock, how you do the initial racking and configuration and so forth. And we've been talking about all these use cases. Why don't we have Jim go and talk a little bit about how you set these things up? For example, if you want to use a web service proxy or an XML firewall, what exactly those things are, what the process of building or developing stuff on DataPower is like in a nutshell. So, Jim, why don't you take it away for us?
Great. Thanks, Bill. Yeah, so you have your device. You've got it all racked and mounted and set up, and it's configured within your network, and you're ready to do a lot of these great things we've been talking about with security and integration and all this other stuff that you've been hearing about within this podcast. So how do we do that? So it's in your network. You're ready to receive some traffic, but you'll quickly realize that that's not possible. You're not going to get any traffic through the device without explicitly configuring it to do so, to expect that traffic and to process it and configure it to do what you really want it to do. So there are a few ways to actually administer the device. You have different interfaces to administer the device with. You can, as you did when you set up the device, you can administer through the serial port and use CLI commands. You can also SSH into the device if you have that enabled. Again, through your CLI commands, you can configure and administer a device. You can use the XML management interface to submit SOAP requests to administer the device. And then last but not least is the web GUI. We talk about configuring the device for building our what we call services or proxies. The web GUI is really going to be where you go to do this. Although you can do this with the other interfaces, primarily you'll find out rather quickly that the web GUI is the way to go to do this. And that's due to the drag and drop interface that you'll see when you go to configure these services. And I keep talking about services, so what is a service really? You're really, on your device, we're talking about configuring proxies. So your data power service is really a proxy. What you do within that proxy could be many different things, as we discuss many different use cases in this episode. So depending on what you want to do with your proxies or services, that will dictate which type of service. There are different types of services available on the data power appliance. There's what they call the web service proxy, and as you might guess, that's for proxying web services. It does a great job of abstracting the web service away from the back end and virtualizing endpoints to the actual clients and hiding the real back end. And what that's the powerful feature there is you simply import a WSDL for your back end web service, and that almost magically creates your service or your proxy for your back end. It will virtualize all the endpoints, expose all the operations which you have a choice to expose or not expose, and really it almost magically, like I said, configures your service for it, and all you have to provide is a front-end listener for it, which we'll talk about. The next big service type is your multi-protocol gateway. Jamie talked about integration and protocol bridging and mediation, things like that. That's the multi-protocol gateway that makes that all possible. As the name implies, it's used for using multiple protocols. So if you're going to be bridging protocols or using a non-HTTP protocol, you're going to be using a multi-protocol gateway. Another service type is the XML firewall. That's dedicated for primarily, it can only be used for HTTP or HTTPS traffic and really used for XML traffic. Then the other big service type is the web application firewall. And again, the name implies it's used for proxying web applications, providing security, and gives you a nice wizard-driven approach to providing security for your back-end web applications. So you can see we have different service types, and again, your use case is going to drive which service type to use, and it might not even be the most obvious one, which we go into in the book on why you might use a service type for which use case. But in any case, no matter which type of service you use, it's primarily doing the same thing, as we said, proxying the back end and configuring it. It's a little different for each service type, but really we're doing the same thing. And any proxy is going to have three main parts. You're going to configure a front-end listener for any service. So how am I going to receive traffic to this service? How's the service going to accept the traffic coming through? With that, we configure typically a front-side handler, although an XML firewall is the exception. You configure an object called a front-side handler. With that, you configure which IP address, which interface you want to listen for traffic on, and which port you want to listen to that traffic on. And once you have that configured, you can use SSL within your front-side handler. So an SSL connection can be made and the handshake established and configured all the options within this front-side handler, which refers to other objects. And you'll quickly notice that data power is very object-oriented. So everything is its own object, most of which are reusable. So then after configuring your front-side listener or front-side handler to receive the traffic, you then move on to the second phase, and that is configuring your processing policy. Now, your processing policy is simply a set of rules that will be applied, really the order in which things will be applied to a message coming in through the service. So it's really all about the processing flow of the message coming through the device, coming through your service, and what you want to do with that message and how you want to handle, authenticate, or all of this good stuff we hear about that Data Power can do. And the processing policy, it's really simple within the web GUI to visualize, because it's a drag and drop editor in each rule. And a rule, again, is just the flow that each message will take. And you can have a request rule, you can have a response rule, and you can also define rules to handle errors in the event of an error. And request and response and error rules can be fired based on different criteria, such as could be message content, could be header content. You can XPath into the message. So a lot of different things you can fire a rule on. So when a request rule is decided, a request rule will be fired on a particular message, you will configure what you want to do with that message. You can transform, you can perform some AAA actions, you can verify, and that's all drag and drop within the GUI. So it's really a left to right processing line. So you drag things left to right in the order in which you want it to be processed. And a little palette above the line, you can see the actions that are available to you, and you just drag them on the line in the order in which you want them to process the message. And there's a whole array of actions that can be applied. So once the message flows through your request rule and applies all of the actions that you've configured, you configure the back end. So the back end is really how you're going to establish a connection to the back end of this service. So where is this message going to go after it's finished processing through the processing rule? And that can be configured to use SSL, or if it's a multi-protocol gateway, you might want to configure it to use different protocols. It doesn't even have to be the same protocol that the message came in on. So then the request message is forwarded to the back end and then would come back on a response. So then you would configure a response rule to handle these responses coming back. And very similar to the request rule, you're going to drag and drop actions in the order in which you want them to be applied to the response rule. Again, it could be a transformation on the response to transform a message back to some other format that the client is expecting. So once the response rule is completed, the request and response are completed and will be forwarded back to the client. So really everything is driven, all processing is driven by this processing policy, request response rules. And no matter which service type you use, it's really going to come down to the same thing, where you're going to configure a front side to listen on. You're going to configure your processing policy, which is what you want to do to that message as it flows through, and what you want to do to that message as it flows back as a response to the client, and what you might want to do to that message in the event of an error. And then the back-end configuration is how you want to forward that request to the back-end server. So basically, like I said, it's three main parts to a service configuration, very nicely laid out within the web GUI, easily configured, and easy to do within the Data Power device to complete a service to process your messages, depending on which use case you might have.
All right. Thanks, Jim. And again, it's something we cover in detail in the book. It's kind of hard to describe on a call, but you know, it's a process similar to creating a workflow or a business flow in some of the other products that you may be familiar with. And you know, also we talk a lot about how easy this is to do in the web GUI, and we do have customers that don't allow browser-based administration. Primarily, that's in the production environments, though, right? We recommend that, at least in development, that the web GUI be used to take advantage of the wizards and so forth. And then after development, your build and deployment can be pushed out to your other environments in the system lifecycle, QA, test, failover, performance, pre-prod, prod, by using a scripted automated process. And John's got a couple of articles out there in the developer works, and we've also dedicated a chapter in the book to that as well, because we know we've got a lot of scripting folks out there that like to automate everything. So the one area that we haven't talked about a lot when we covered the setup and configuration is really the networking environment and how the network interfaces are typically used, which is an important set of use cases in its own. And I mentioned that Simon, you know, was our big network expert on the book here. So Simon, I wanted to talk a little bit about how people typically use these interfaces, a little bit about the specifications around them, and some of the other best practices that we cover in the networking chapters of the book.
Cool. So fundamentally, I mean, data power isn't really that different as a network device to a typical multi-homed general-purpose computer, multi-homed Unix machine, for instance. And it has four network ports, gigabit network ports. It runs services, as Jim described. It's got ports where it will listen for incoming connections, and it makes connections out to a back end. It has a routing table and so on. And at the same time, it also has a CLI, a command line interface, which is very similar in look and feel to iOS, which is the operating system that's used on many network routers. I mean, if anyone comes from a networking background, they're going to feel right at home configuring the device via the CLI. And it also comes with a lot of very advanced networking features itself. I mean, for instance, support for 802.11q tagging, so VLANs, virtual interfaces, can be configured to communicate with using VLANs directly on the device itself. It's kind of obvious when you're configuring data power that the appliance networking is an area that it's very comfortable in. Whenever you see a configuration, for instance, for a netmask, so you have a network address and a netmask, usually you specify in CIDR form rather than the typical sort of dotted quad notation, and it's a natural part of configuring the device, as it were. So there's a few things that tend to trip customers up when they're dealing with networking and data power. And a big one of those, one of the ones that's quite commonly seen, is the actual network interface themselves. Like I said, there's 4 gigabit network interfaces. One of those interfaces is labeled as, I think it's NGT0. It's referred to very often as the admin interface. It's also ETH4. But it's generally known as NGT0. And I often get asked, you know, what's the difference between the admin interface and all the other interfaces in the appliance? And fundamentally, there isn't any actual real difference. The real point is that a common network configuration that tends to be used by customers, by organizations deploying large complex network environments, is to have a dedicated and isolated management network. And that network is designed for managing and configuring and monitoring all sorts of network appliances. So the reason we dedicate one of these network interfaces, we call it the admin interface, we map it to have a separate name on the device, is explicitly so that to encourage the use of this practice, and to, you know, we suggest that people use this interface for that connection. Fundamentally, admin traffic doesn't belong on a production network. So the network where your business traffic, your web services requests and response, and your JDBC connections to the back end and so on are being sent, your admin traffic doesn't really belong on that network and shouldn't be there. Now, of course, data power encrypts all of the administrator's traffic by default. So when you try and access the GUI, it always goes over SSL. If you try and use the external management interface, it goes over SSL. The SSH connection, of course, is encrypted and so on. And you'd expect that. But as a point of order, all of the administrative interfaces shouldn't really even be bound to the production network at all. And that's why we have this admin interface. Another thing that often tricks customers up in the networking area, and something I get asked about quite a lot, is if they that customers want to configure the device such that you have one network interface which is used for inbound traffic coming from clients, and a separate network interface that's used for outbound traffic to go to back-end servers. And on the face of it, that's a very sensible thing to do. That's not a bad idea at all. But the point is that you have to remember that fundamentally, data power is just another network device. It has an IP routing table just like any other network device. Yes, it's a pretty advanced networking device, but it's not a router. And if you do want to set up a configuration where you've got one interface coming in for outbound traffic, inbound traffic, and another one for outbound traffic, you can do that, but only if you have your network set up such that your back-end servers are addressable in that manner, so that the routing table on Data Power, whether that's configured by static routes or by having a specific router that understands, or by segmenting the network up, such that its routing table knows how to send the traffic to those servers. Back to you, Bill.
Okay, thank you very much, Simon. And I have to say that I think, you know, the networking chapters in this book are so incredibly valuable, not just for Data Power, but to understand a lot of just basic networking stuff that really baffles a lot of the common man, right? Routing tables and how they work, and static routes and gateways and all that. I think it's really important to understand all that stuff, and not just for Data Power. And that was kind of one of our goals with the book was, and I learned this from my first book, we intentionally wrote the WebSphere application server book so that it wasn't too specific to any particular version of the product. We tried to fill the book with just generic, useful, best practice advice, and that's really worked out well for us because that book is still selling years after the fact, even after the products that it was based on are no longer supported, because the advice is still good and pertinent advice for the current versions of that product. And we did the same thing with this Data Power book. Very little in there is version specific. And we did have our own challenges because just as we were finishing the book, a major new release of the firmware came out. So we had to quickly go in and yet again delay our release to the publisher by updating all the different areas that were related to this new firmware release. So I think that's important. You know, a lot of the stuff in this book is not going to be outdated as soon as Data Power comes out with a new version of firmware or something like that. It's still useful information that's going to hold true for quite some time. And I think, you know, one of the things that's changed is that it used to be all the interfaces were identical, but now we're seeing with the newer versions of the hardware that only certain ones can be used, for example, to connect to storage area networks and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's just the kind of thing you really have to watch out for. Okay, I think we'll wrap up episode 2 of our podcast at this point. Thank you all for tuning in, and I want to make you aware that we will have one more episode. This will be episode 3. And in that one, I think each of us will just go through and talk about some of our favorite customer implementations. We won't be naming names, of course. Some of you may think some of this sounds very familiar, and we might not even be talking about you because we find customers use these devices in a lot of similar ways. But we'll try to pick out some of the more interesting usages and provide you with some more valuable information along the way. So please tune in for episode 3 of the podcast.